this is what's going on in our community, and we need to have honest conversations about what that looks like. And again, what's the role of government? What's the role of the church? What's the role of our nonprofits in order to try to like move into a healthier place?
Welcome back to season 3 of Intrinsically Motivated, where we have conversations with experts in the field of addiction, recovery, and those personally affected by it, as we seek to mobilize the church to replace addiction and mental health challenges with flourishing. On today's episode, we'll be sitting down with Aaron Scott, an independent consultant for the City of Johnson City for Preventing Homelessness. I'm Tucker Clements, audio engineer and editor for Uplift Appalachia, and this is Intrinsically Motivated. We work together.
That's right. Well, I mean, we go way back.
That was what I was going to say, just to kind of like to start off. Like when we first met, I was working in academic technology at ETSU, and you were also working in academic technology.
Yeah.
Had you just moved to the area when you started there?
Yeah. Or? So my first time coming to the East Tennessee area was I came to be a Milligan student.
Okay.
Yeah. So met my wife at college. We got married here in East Tennessee, but then we moved around the country while she did grad school. So I had been back for a number of years at that point. We moved back in 2010. So my oldest is now a sophomore at Science Hill, and he was like 1 year old at that time. So it seems like a long time ago.
Well, it's like, and I have a 13-year-old now who's like almost done with middles. It's wild to think how quickly that time flies.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, when I came to academic technology support, that was, I had just, been let go from working at a nonprofit here that works with homeless families. And so I was looking for a job and I was unemployed, had two kids, was unemployed for a number of months. And so that opportunity was great just because it gave me an opportunity to get, in the door at ETSU. It was a really good department. They were just like really good people.
Yeah, so
it was
a nice team, team for those years. Cause I mean, I was there. Had you already, because you ended up moving in on to pharmacy and public health to do like fundraising and stuff like that for them. Mm-hmm. Did you leave before I left or did I leave before? It was around the same time, I feel like, because I ended up going over to marketing to do video around then too, which is probably around the same time that you were.
Yeah. So I think I was in like the support staff role for about a year and a half.
That's
and then
right.
I was in fundraising at the university for about 5 years. Yeah. So all told, it was just shy of 7 years that I worked in sort of higher ed, which was sort of a detour of sorts away from the primary like thing that has been my career. Like I was a middle school teacher for a number of years, but then mostly have worked in faith-based nonprofits.
Right.
So the fundraising and higher ed was sort of adjacent to that, but
you knew how that worked, you understood the people, and I'm sure, you know, working in the nonprofit world, I mean, just networking is massive. And even if you're not, like, even in my position where I was doing web or video or whatever, you know, just the getting to know, I got to know so many people through that, which kind of set me up to be a bit more confident in talking to people and you know, talking about the things that I get to do, but also just knowing all these people that know so many people is just, it's really handy when you kind of are in the world that we're now kind of walking in all the time.
So, like one of the things that was helpful about that is that you see how diverse like nonprofits are and all the different things nonprofits do, both from like a service impact, like some are focused on education or the environment or health or homelessness or addiction or like whatever. There's a million different focus areas, but it's like running a business. Like you have to know marketing and you have to know fundraising and you have to know
it's fewer people having to know a lot more of those things.
Yeah, you wear a lot of hats
to be able to do that. One of our biggest things for us, one of my biggest goals has been to try to find ways to have as many other people support what we're doing, like just doing the things. Because like I realized real quickly, I mean, I quit my job at ETSU now. It's been a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I was doing lots of things. And now I'm still doing lots of things, but I've been able to hand off some of the things that used to I would have held near and dear. And that's the hardest. That was the hardest part for me is just learning
to delegate.
I can't do all the social media this podcast. I've been wanting to get this podcast more consistent for years. I'd recorded 3 or 4 episodes and it's like, I'm not going to be able to manage this. Right. So that's why old Tux sits over here and listens to me while I talk. And
you need a team.
And you have to have the team, which is, I mean, fits our model for what we're wanting to see happen in people's right. lives with addiction and all. So, you know, like you need people in your lives to, you need consistency and community and connection mm-hmm. and all those things to kind of live that out.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I think something by nature, I'm pretty collaborative, which I think lends itself to this kind of world and sort of the serving or helping profession. Like you realize pretty quick, if you try to do everything on your own, it's really easy to burn out. And it's also easy to get into sort of a savior complex, as if like, I'm here to help you and save you, as opposed to what I think is, you know, as a Christian, a much healthier model, which is like, we're called to come alongside people and we're called to be faithful, whatever that looks like, but we're not responsible for the results.
And we're not God. So yeah, we can't do it all. Yeah.
So just having a healthy understanding of like, what is it you're actually trying to do? I'm trying to be faithful with what I feel like I've been given as the next step, but I hold that very loosely. And I trust that whether that produces the thing I think it's going to produce or not is not my sort of focus.
Right. So, I mean, you said you came, so when you started ATSU, you said you had been let go of, from a nonprofit working on homelessness. Yeah. What were you doing there before?
Yeah, so I worked at Family Promise for about 2.5 years. They're the lead agency that works with families with kids. We actually just like last week had some churches in conversation about family homelessness again, just because the numbers are on the rise. And it was a similar kind of gathering. A group of churches gathered in the late 90s. People like Brian Rosecrantz at First United Methodist Downtown, who later became my boss at Family Promise, like Steve Baldwin, who worked with the city and was part of Muncie, Calvin Ross, who was part of Grandview Christian Church. Some of these leaders, a generation before us, having similar conversations to this about how do we help the vulnerable in our community, came together and churches started what was called Interfaith Hospitality Network or Family Promise.
Right.
And they've been doing amazing ministry work for like 25 years. So I worked there for 2.5 years. We had a leadership transition where Brian retired, and it was just like, yeah, there was a lot that happened in that transition.
Yeah.
But I was let go, a lot of turnover on the staff. And that, again, provided, it, that was a tough season for me personally, but it provided, again, opportunities
you
to learn.
You didn't know why,
grow.
But there was a reason. And then now you're in a place where you're kind of back into doing some of that, doing all that work again.
So sort of housing and homelessness has been the primary area sort of in the nonprofit sector that I've had the opportunity to work.
So, and we, I guess we kind of reconnected on a couple of these things, mm-hmm. you know, several months ago. We were both talking at an event called the Love Your Neighbor conversation, which was just trying to get churches and folks to get together to talk about. I mean, I think we talked about homelessness. We talked about trauma and adversity. And then we talked, there was one other speaker that was talking
about Hurricane Helene.
Right. So like disaster relief and that sort of, that's right. Mm-hmm. And we kind of reconnected then. And that was the first time I'd kind of gotten to hear kind of your story that kind of brought you up into this. So, so you obviously have been focused a lot on homelessness. Where did that come from? I'd love to hear some of that again.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, at Milligan, I did Bible and history and was certified to teach, but I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do in my career. Like, I knew I liked working with people, I liked working with kids, but I wasn't sure if I was just going to be a full-time teacher my whole career and sort of do, you know, just loving on people through, you know, not specific ministry work, quote unquote, or if I would work in a church in some capacity. And so I feel like I kind of stumbled my way into the faith-based nonprofit world. When I was at ATSU, you know, like when you're doing fundraising full-time for a job, I don't think anyone grows up saying, you know what I want to do is when I grow up, I want to ask people for money. Like, that's not like, I want to be an astronaut or something.
It doesn't sound like one of those
how do you even get into doing that? And how do you find that enjoyable? Or, you know, but really this kind of work is you have to really be passionate about the mission of what you're doing and then asking people for support, whether that's their volunteer time or their gifts and talents or their money or space.
And that's exactly what it is. It's not that you want to grow up to ask people for money. You want to grow up to ask people to partner with you in a thing you're passionate about.
Yeah. And so, yeah, really. Yeah. So I was exposed to that first in Chicago because we graduated from Milligan, got married, moved to Chicago for my wife to work on her master's. And we, in Chicago, we got a part of a church community that was just very, I mean, they call it an intentional Christian community, which is kind of like a $5 word for just like being the church in a way that maybe looks countercultural in America in the 21st century, but maybe isn't so different than the way like the Acts 2 early church is described. So
all
they
together
would,
and having all things in common.
So like they shared property, they had like a common purse. So it's almost more like a monastic order, like a monastery. It's actually classified as a 501D organization, more like a monastery. And so it's even a different classification than your typical church. Anyway, that's getting into the weeds. So these people were Christians that were just living out their faith in a way that I hadn't really ever seen done before. And they had started nonprofits that did housing and they did refugee work and all sorts of different things. And that really sort of introduced me to this whole world. Then when we came back here to East Tennessee, it was easy to then plug into these kind of programs and ministries like my church, Hopwood Christian Church, had been a part of IHN and, you know, being able to volunteer. And then again, Brian Rosecrans was the one that hired me at Family Promise and sort of gave me the opportunity to work in a field where, like, and he told me when he interviewed me, like, you don't have the skills that other people have, but I can see that you have a heart for this work and I can train you how to write a grant.
You can learn how to do the stuff, right?
Yeah, like, so I'll train you because I see that you have a passion for this. And so, like, I'm grateful for that because somebody like invested in me because they saw that I wanted to give back.
So what kind of eye-opening or life lesson kind of moments did you have in that community?
So Reba Place, I think, is powerful because one of the things that I think it taught me is that proximity is important. And I think that's something that's applicable regardless of your context. I don't think that necessarily, like, when you start talking about a radical church model, a lot of people are like, I don't know if I want to sign up for that. But I think there's ways for all of us to be intentional in terms of being in proximity with other people, because that proximity kind of like puts our relationships in an incubator and it helps things develop faster and it builds intimacy more deeply. And I think that's something that all of our churches can learn to do differently, is like, whether that's internally with building relationships, like actually getting to know people within your own church community at a deeper level, that you're not just always on surface levels, but in the work we do, also challenging the church to actually like be proximate to vulnerable people, because it's through that proximity that you're actually transformed and they're transformed.
Which I mean, just to, cause I love to, you know, plug our model too, you know, is like with rides sharing in specific, it's like, it's a different thing that, like, yes, we have government programs like NetTrans, which will pick somebody up and they will get them to the place they need to go.
Right.
But it's going to be a person pulls up in a bus. You're going to sit in the back seat. You're not going to know the person's name and all that. Whereas if you have somebody hop in your car with you and they sit next to you and you have a conversation.
Yeah.
I was just doing that this morning. I got a text earlier the week. Hey, can you pick this guy up? He's been in a 28-day detox program and take him over to this, you know, prison diversion program that he's going to be a part of now. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I may never see that guy again, but the first person that he saw was somebody that knew his name and he hopped in the car with me and we had a conversation as I drove him over there. And it's a completely different experience than you're going to have riding on a bus.
Yeah.
And it's that proximity. Like, I love that word, because it's like, it's intentionally trying to be close, because You don't get to hide as much when you do that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the temptation is to go sit in the back of the car, pull out your phone, and just detach.
Right.
And when you sit next to somebody, it's like, I kind of feel like I need to talk to this person now, and you can't escape it.
And I think that's a great example of how you guys have identified an unmet need and in like an underserved area. Like, transportation is a huge gap in rural America. Mm-hmm. That's a real challenge to even folks who are housed, like having the ability to get access to groceries, to get access to the pharmacy, to get access to healthcare. Like, how do you access
that? It's hard to keep your home if you can't keep a job.
Yeah.
And it's hard to keep a job if you can't get there. And so it's like, if we can meet that one need meets so many different things that we can try to break this cycle of poverty or you know, homelessness, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And that's, and I think one of the other things that you said, when you kind of mentioned this idea of when you're around each other in this really intentional way, is this idea of like vulnerability. Like, you don't, and I'm sure you experienced this when you were in Chicago, this idea that like, you're not hiding the uncomfortable parts of your life from people. There's not really a putting up a barrier and saying, hey, I'm struggling. I don't want people to know that I'm struggling. Like, if you're around the same people all the time, as much as you can be, you don't get to, and that seems uncomfortable. And I think that's probably what's off-putting to people that think of, like you were saying, kind of a radical church ministry approach, but it's like, it's learning that not only is it okay to kind of show off some of the struggles that you may be experiencing, but also at the same time, the more you're around people, the more you learn to trust one another mm-hmm. through that transparency, right?
Yeah.
You know, that it makes it easier to then know when somebody needs support, even if they're not necessarily comfortable asking for it too.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, not to sort of like paint with too broad a brush, but I think like it is pretty clear looking back now, like, I mean, we're about the same age, like I'm early 40s. Like, as I look back and think about like the attitudes I had about like unhoused people or the idea of addiction, like there was just a lot of stigma and shame around that. Yep. So I think we also need to name that, like, I don't think the church has done a great job with that.
Exactly.
So being vulnerable and talking about what you struggle with, like anything, like what we call sin in the church, but just any moral challenges or shortcomings. And to be clear, like homelessness is not always a result of some sort of moral failure. In fact, most of the time it's not. It's intergenerational poverty. It's things like addiction. It's things like mental health challenges that aren't a person saying, you know what, I want to grow up and like choose to become an addict and choose to become homeless. Like,
which is present because sin is present in the world.
Sure.
But it's not always that same kind of active.
Right.
It may be that somebody in your family.
Yeah.
helped guide you into a, you know, or we talk a lot about adversity and trauma and how those things, you know, help cause rewriting parts of our brain. And now it's harder for us to maybe make either wise decisions, or we have to, we're looking for some solution that we don't know we could find in the body of Christ.
Right.
And so people look for solutions lots of different ways. And yes, there's moral failure in that. And yes, there's sin present in that. There's sin happening to and from people. But at the same time, just because one sin seems a little bit, you know, yuckier, I guess, to some people. Yeah. And they don't, and I don't think the church has done as an adequate job of educating itself on, you know, how people find themselves in the situation and just how oppressive these situations are and how hard it is to break that cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, like, I mean, I have a history of alcohol addiction in my family. So like seeing how those things are present and how, even though I don't struggle with alcoholism, like how, because my dad did and his dad did, and seeing the role that addiction has played in my own like family history. My dad's originally from rural West Virginia. So it's like also just knowing, now living in Appalachia and like understanding Appalachian poverty is a part of the way of me understanding my own history and my own story of my family.
Yeah.
Where it's not the same, it doesn't map on one to one, but like I can find places where I can say, like, I sort of understand to a degree what some people are experiencing in our community who are struggling with some of these challenges. So yeah, it's humbling because, again, I think maybe as a church, we are doing a better job acknowledging that we haven't always done it perfectly and we need to do a better job. And I think a good place to start is what we already talked about, intentional proximity to people who are vulnerable.
Right. And what better way to learn about the situation that people are in than to be near them while they're working their way through that situation and to ask. And this is the thing that we found. And I don't know if in your work you found this to be true too, but it's like most people aren't afraid to answer questions about their life.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't think that you're treating them like, oh, you're my little test subject,
right,
but rather I'm genuinely concerned for you. And I want to hear your story. I want to know about, you know, your life, your situation, the things that you've learned, the things that you've experienced, the things that have happened to you, you know, not to exploit you, but just because I care for you. And for the most part, people are more than willing to have, you know, really meaningful conversations. And that's where we have learned the most about what we don't understand.
Yeah.
And then we begin to say, okay, well, I want to understand this better so that I can help people that are in that situation.
I mean, for me, I think a good way to do that, because, you know, interacting with people who are different than you, whether that's somebody from a different religion, somebody from a different race, somebody from a different socioeconomic background, or like interacting with somebody who's unhoused, like it is like uncomfortable. Like, what do I talk about? Like, actually just approaching any conversation with just a spirit of curiosity is really, I think, a powerful way to just sort of like, hey, I'd like to learn more about you. Like, what would you like to talk about? Tell me about your day. Tell me about your story. What I find is that usually people like vomit all sorts of stuff onto you and tell you like so many personal details, and you're like, oh, okay, we got really vulnerable really fast. And they're just like, here's my history of trauma, and gosh, I was exposed to drugs in the home when I was six, and all these things. And you're like, I would be in the same position as you if I had your life story. Like, I can completely sympathize with that. Like, thank you for sharing that story for me. And then you begin to build a relationship. I know that person's name. I know what they struggle with. I know how difficult it's going to be for them to stabilize. But now I have a better understanding of what it looks like for me to be a neighbor and come alongside them.
And a lot of that is coming from that kind of, and we call it intrinsic motivation, that internal desire, that care for people. Kind of going back to the one we were talking about, like, I don't just want to fundraise for a nonprofit. That's not the career I want, but because I'm passionate about the mission, that's what I do.
Yeah.
And so it's like, but if we're passionate, we care for people, we're naturally going to be inquisitive and ask good questions and have more meaningful conversations, not because we're poking and prodding, but just because I genuinely care for this person's success and I want them to do well. And so I'm going to have a much more meaningful conversation and I'm going to be more intentional in the way that I approach that conversation because of, you know, the way that I want to see them succeed. I can give you an example. It's like there's a guy that I've now driven, you know, several times, you know, for Uplift. And the very first time I got in the car with them, I mean, we were in the car for probably 20 minutes while we were riding, and it was like nothing specific was said that triggered this in me, but I just felt like I really want this guy to succeed. There was just some connection that I immediately made, and then every time I drove with him, it's the same thing you said. It's like he had no problem sharing more and more of his story, and I learned more and more of his story. Maybe someday I'll get him on the podcast.
Yeah,
but it's like the more and more he shares, like this is a guy that I really want to I want to see do, and I think I wouldn't feel that way for him if I hadn't put myself in that situation where I'm going to be close to him and in a position where I have no choice but to have a conversation. And I think sometimes it's just, we have to go. We have to go do something. Just try something and that sort of thing. So are you working with a particular organization trying to help people who are unhoused right now?
Yeah, good question. So again, I've worked, after I left ETSU, I worked at the Salvation Army, which is a faith-based nonprofit, international organization, big, do a lot of great work all over. They run one of the largest homeless shelters in our region. They have a program with veterans. So I worked with them from 2021 to 2020, to last fall, to 2024. I just kind of felt like it was maybe time for a change. I wasn't really sure what was next. It's the first time I'd ever like quit a job without knowing what I was doing next. Right. So there was a little bit of like trust there. I was actually approached by somebody who had been doing work with some consulting work with the city of Johnson City, helping them to implement a homeless strategic plan. My friend, Dr. Opal Fry Clark, she brings sort of a research background to her work and had researched homelessness in Johnson City and had written this draft strategic plan. So she approached me and said, what would you think about joining the city as a second consultant? So this is the point in the conversation where I say, I am paid by the city of Johnson City to consult, to help them implement a plan, but I'm not a city employee. I don't speak on behalf of the city. Right. Like, you know, so I'm not like, here's what Johnson City believes is right and wrong. Like, that's not my role. Our role is
here's
basically
the facts that I've informed them.
Yeah. So like we try to facilitate a community response. So we work with a lot of the service providers like Salvation Army, like Good Sam, like The Haven, like Family Promise, all these good players that have been doing good work in our community for a long time. But then also trying to get conversations about affordable housing, trying to get conversations about where are there gaps in services, who are new groups, new churches, new individuals, new organizations that we can get to fill those spaces to make sure we have more of a comprehensive response to the issue.
Yeah. So, and you don't have to be super specific if you don't have that number and stuff, but I'm just curious, like, so what are the numbers or percentages or what is the statistic that you track to kind of, if you're going to present to say the city and give them a picture of what the situation actually is like here?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the big things that we talk about is the chronically homeless, is only one segment of the homeless population nationally and locally. That's the most visible part. So when you see a person who is, you know, panhandling on the street and they are clearly unhoused because they tell you or they have a sign that says, I'm homeless, I need food, or give me money because I need whatever. Like, that's become more visible in Johnson City. And so I think people sort of know that homelessness is on the rise. But they see that that's the only face of homelessness, and homelessness is much more complex than that. So the way we know that to be true is that each year, HUD, the Federal Housing and Urban Development Office nationally, requires us to do what's called the point in time count or the PIT count. And this is organized by ARCH, our regional continuum of care. ARCH is the Appalachian Regional Coalition on Homelessness.
So many acronyms.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's great. No, we need them.
So they're the lead agency for homelessness for an 8-county region of Northeast Tennessee.
Okay.
So we know from the PIT count data that homelessness is on the rise, and not just for that chronically street homeless, that unhoused, chronically homeless population, but in other subpopulations too, like LGBT youth, unaccompanied youth, families with kids, the elderly, veterans, all these subpopulations locally in our area and nationally, the numbers are going in the wrong direction. Because last year, I think it was 778,000 people nationally were counted as homeless as a part of those point in time counts.
So what does it take to count as that? Educate me on that.
I mean, that's a great way to get involved. Is ARCH always is needing more volunteers to be involved in the PIT count. It happens every January. And so there's a PIT count committee to where service providers and different groups participate in like formulating the plan. But again, they're trying to count people across an 8-county region.
Right.
And this is a very rural community. And then last year we had Hurricane Helene had just happened a few months prior. So there were more people who were unhoused because they, you know, were unhoused because of the disaster. So that was a whole other wrinkle.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're interested in learning more about the PIT, it's basically like street outreach. You're basically like going to places where you know there are encampments.
Right.
You're obviously counting people who are also what are called sheltered. So again, it gets technical pretty fast, but basically when we're doing the PIT count, there's two basic categories. You have sheltered and unsheltered. And then you have within the sheltered, you have people that are in transitional housing or in emergency shelter. And those are two different types of beds.
Yeah. I guess that was kind of my follow-up question to that, was just like understanding what makes that PIT count a yes versus a no. Like what makes it somebody, because you mentioned the chronically homeless, that picture that I think most people have, but what can being unhoused look like if you're not that person that you just see, like you said, sitting on the side of the road or whatever?
Yeah.
Like what does it look like to also still be considered unhoused?
Correct. Yeah. So it can look like different things. So the question in the survey is, where did you sleep last night? So it's for a 24-hour period from sundown on one night to sundown on the next, you know, it's a 24-hour period. And the question is, where did you sleep the night of January 24th? And if somebody says, I slept in a place not fit for human habitation, is basically HUD's definition. And so if you're sleeping in a shed, if you're sleeping in a car, if you're sleeping under a bridge, if you're sleeping on railroad tracks.
Any of those things count.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you have, obviously, the sheltered homeless are people that are in programs, things like the transitional housing beds that Fairview Housing provides here in our community, the emergency shelter beds that Salvation Army provides.
Right.
We obviously want to count those folks too. People at the VA who are in the domiciliary that are technically homeless vets, but they're in this homeless program with the VA. All of these programs are also counting those people because they're like in the system on their pathway to getting rehoused.
Right.
Versus the chronically homeless who are unhoused on the street. We're trying to get them into the system to get rehoused.
So for all those people that are in that situation, obviously you said this was like, there was like an 8-county area that you're counting. Is most of that centered in a particular, like, I guess more urban area, or is it pretty diverse and spread out, or what does that look like?
Yeah.
Kind of do more people. Cause one of the things that we've kind of observed again is like downtown Johnson City is where a lot of the services are offered. And so there's a lot of folks that kind of congregate in that direction because there are a lot of services there.
Right.
But also those same people have, you know, maybe a court appointment in Jonesboro or whatever.
Exactly.
So are most of the people that you end up counting in those kind of urban areas closer to services, or is it pretty evenly spread out around the region?
Yeah, it reflects population. So the numbers are highest in Johnson City, in Kingsport, in Bristol, in the metro areas where we do have larger numbers of homeless. But like you said, part of the reason why probably, like, if you were unhoused, you would say, well, I need to eat to survive. Well, I need to try to have a place to try to access shelter. So like people, I think, are attracted to Johnson City because we do have some services that don't exist in other parts of the region. Think about it like a food desert. Like right. Appalachia is a service desert. And relatively speaking, even though Johnson City doesn't have tons of resources, we're relatively asset rich compared to our rural surrounding counties.
Right.
So if you're homelessness, if you're homeless in Hancock County or Johnson County or out by Roan Mountain, you're probably going to make your way into Elizabethton because there's more resources there. And then you might make your way to Johnson City because yeah. there's more resources there. So a lot of people speculate that like other bigger communities are like busing their homeless to us, like from Asheville or Knoxville. Mm-hmm. Like I, from a, to a person, every person that I've talked to who's experiencing homelessness, I've never talked to one person that told me that's their story.
Right.
I can't say it's not happening.
Right.
I don't think it's happening in the numbers that some people think.
Right.
I do think what we see regionally is we see people that are marginalized or like vulnerable in our rural surrounding counties. And they end up coming to Johnson City because we have a VA hospital. We yeah. have a level one trauma hospital. We have public transportation. We have two emergency shelters. These are all assets that other smaller communities don't have.
Yeah.
So are you going to stay in Elizabethton where there's not as many resources? Are you going
to
stay
come to Johnson City where
in Bluff City or Piney Flats? Or, you know, yeah. you know, so it's not.
And that's consistent yeah. too, because I mean, when we kind of help maintain a database of like recovery meetings in our area.
Yeah.
And pre-COVID, there was, I don't remember what the final number was. I'm going to say there was 100. It was more than that. But say there were 100 sure. consistent recovery meetings, and they were kind of spread throughout the region.
Mm-hmm.
They all closed down during COVID.
Mm.
And then we're back to that same number now since COVID, but they've all now centered in the urban areas.
Mm.
Like we don't have nearly as many rural recovery meetings that are happening,
interesting.
Focusing on addiction. And I think it's that same kind of natural migration.
Yeah.
It's like it's easier to kind of congregate, but that does leave more marginalized people, maybe people that don't have access to transportation, that are yeah. in those same situations kind of being left behind even more, which
right.
creates this even bigger discrepancy yeah. and all that, which is why, you know, we're interested in trying to say, okay, so there are a lot of Johnson City resources or there are a lot of Kingsport City resources mm-hmm. in these urban areas. Who's out in these rural areas? And that's why we say it's the church. Like there yeah. are still churches out in those areas.
Yeah. And there are great partners, you know, that Arch works with in Irwin. You know, there is a domestic violence mm-hmm. shelter in Irwin CHIPS. You know, there are service providers in Carter County. There's great, like my church Hopwood works closely with ARM. It's the largest, Area Assistance Resource Ministries is what ARM stands for. They're the largest food pantry in Carter County. The Carter Compassion Center, Loaves right. and Fishes. There are public feeding programs and there are things in like Carter County, but there's not an emergency shelter. So
right.
if you know, so like there are resources primarily driven towards vulnerable families that are housed.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really important programs because there's a lot of data about how many people are cost burdened who are in housing. And that's another driver of homelessness that like we just don't talk enough about, is that it isn't all people who are chronically homeless or who, you know, are unhoused because they're not willing to work. We have a lot of people who are working sometimes multiple jobs, but they're just not making enough to keep up with housing prices. The city of Johnson City did two recent housing studies, what are called the Bowen Reports, and they're on the city website. If you just Google Johnson City Bowen Report, you'll get to the city's website where you can read them. They're fascinating information because it really gives us an insight into what's the housing portfolio in our region, and then looking at people who are housed, like how much of their money are they spending on housing? So like a huge number of our people, almost half, it's about 44% of our people are cost burdened in the housing they're in, mm-hmm. meaning they're spending more than 30% of their money on rent. And one out of every five, about 20%, are extremely cost burdened, meaning they're spending more than 50% of their income just right. on housing. Well, then you're making choices. I'm not going to get my medicine, or I can't afford gas, or I can't afford to do this or do that. You know, so how do you choose the, that's why my lights are cut off, because I couldn't afford to pay my power
right.
bill, because, you know, so we have all these families that are doing the best they can, but like in some ways the deck is stacked against them and they're housed, but they're precariously housed. And I tell you what, if a large percentage of those people become unhoused, it's much more expensive. It's much more difficult
right.
to get them rehoused.
And I'm sure that has a lot to do also with just the huge influx of people that are moving to the region,
yes.
which is helping to, of course, keep those,
it's a market,
those,
yeah,
those, that market inflated and all of, yeah, this.
And we have data on that too. So like from 2010 to 2021, our whole region, many of the rural surrounding counties didn't grow at all. They were flat or they maybe even shrunk in population. Washington County was one of the few counties that actually grew over that 10-year period. Total for over those 11 years, the whole region grew by 11,000 people. And then COVID happened. It's a huge disruptor. But then right after COVID happened, people are like, I can work remote. Tennessee has no state income tax. It's a beautiful place to live. It's affordable. And people started moving here. And then over the years from 2021 till now, we've grown by 17,000 people, whereas we'd only grown by 11 over the previous 11 years.
Right.
So it's like all of a sudden rapid growth puts new pressures on your housing market. And now even working folks, so you hear people talking a lot about workforce housing. Now even nurses and school teachers and firefighters and people who are just working professionals, blue collar kind of people, can't afford the housing that they've been in. And they're living in the same house, but their rents are higher. They're having to move and live outside Johnson City and commute to work,
which is another cost burden.
Exactly. So they, yeah, have to drive 25, 30 minutes to and from work. So all these things are factors. So we're trying, in terms of our consultant work, we're trying to just have honest conversations about this is what's going on in our community. And we need to have honest conversations about what that looks like. And again, what's the role of government? What's the role of the church? What's the role of our nonprofits,
right,
in order to try to like move into a healthier place.
So do you all just present data and facts, or do you also present recommendations and stuff as you kind of observe?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely things that we look at what other communities do. And then we have, obviously, what works in a bigger urban area may not work in Johnson City. There's also state law differences. So what works in a different state, a different community in a different state may not work in Johnson City. But there are things like density and zoning and planning. And we try to give insight into some of that. We thankfully, because we're consultants, we have access to working with the city planner, or we meet with the city manager, or we meet with the economic development staff to say, as you guys go about a housing strategy, keep these things in mind. You know, think about zoning, like these zoning laws that are currently in effect may prohibit the development of opening a new shelter, and we may need a new shelter just because the population's growing. So like, how do we incentivize a climate that just doesn't say, we'll open, like, we don't want bad landlords with like slums and
right,
you know, bad housing that's going to become deteriorated and not taken care of.
But continue to contribute to that same cycle again, where,
yeah,
there's kind of these generational issues that continue to kind of lead right back into the same situation.
But again, there could be things like what you would fall under the zoning term, an accessory dwelling unit, which we could call a tiny home. Like, would you allow somebody to put a tiny home on their property, which then could house an unhoused individual? Or would you allow a small tiny home of 19 tiny homes to be built on a vacant property next to a church that could rehouse some folks who have been unhoused? That's happening in other communities. A guy that I know from that studied in Emmanuel Christian Seminary is a pastor in Portland, Oregon, at St. John's Church. And they had a vacant lot, and they were approached by the city of Portland, and they said, hey, would the city let us use the land? Or excuse me, would the church let us use the land? The city will pay for it, and we will bring in a nonprofit partner to manage it. And they built 19 tiny homes on the church property and are now housing unhoused folks. The city still, or the church still owns the land. Like, they,
right,
didn't give it to the city. They still maintain ownership.
Yeah.
But they got a nonprofit to bring their expertise. Like, we don't know how to manage
and case
manage. Like, you guys do that, but we're going to offer our space,
yeah,
because we think the church needs to be a part of this solution.
And I'd be fascinated to find out what the relationship between the church and the folks that are living in those houses ends,
yeah,
up, how,
yeah,
that ends up.
I mean, David's talked, he was moved to like think about that because he came to work in the morning and saw unhoused people like under the awning of the church by the door and was just like, hey, how can I help you? And he just like felt helpless. Like, we're in this sea of all this homelessness and there's nothing we can do. So when he was approached with a practical like, hey,
this
can your church be involved?
Do.
They're like, we can't change everything. We can't fix everything, but we can take this step. And as you can imagine, they got a lot of pushback from some of their neighbors surrounding,
yep,
the church because they're in a residential area.
And there's going to be some mess that comes with that,
yeah,
that you have to work,
yeah,
through. And you have to know some of these situations aren't going to work out great. Some of these might end really poorly. There may be, you know, some real stressors put on us,
yeah,
but you have to count that cost. It's like, is it worth being willing to serve people even at the risk of it getting a little bit messy as you do that?
And that was one of the themes in the talk I gave at the Love Your Neighbor. Like I said, it's going to cost you something. Like, be under no illusions. And this is true for our community. If we don't do anything and we just try to maintain the status quo, it's going to cost us something because we're not going to be proactive. We're not going to have a plan. And yes, being proactive and doing things in new ways is going to stretch us and challenge us. And it's going to make some of us uncomfortable. And people are going to say, what about my property value? Or what about safety? Or what about, and we need to have public dialogue about the best way to take the best approach that works for our community. I'm not saying what worked at St. John's in Portland is what we need to do, but we need to have conversations about,
think outside the box.
Would a tiny home community be allowable? If so, where? Do we have a nonprofit partner that could help manage it, to help keep it safe,
right,
to help support services, wraparound services for the people who are housed there? That can work here. It worked, you know, Community First in Austin, Texas. There are great models around the nation that we could say, what does it look like to try to replicate some of that here, or maybe try something new here that works for our community based on our gifts, our talents, and our challenges?
Yeah. Are you familiar with Proverbs 14:4?
I couldn't quote it to you.
I was going to say, I would imagine, usually I throw that one out. You've probably heard it. It became my life verse right as we were getting started doing this kind of work. And it kind of goes back to what you were just saying. There's going to be a cost to it. It's the where there are no oxen, the manger is clean, but abundant crops come by the strength of the ox. So like, sure, you can have a barn that you don't have to clean up after, you know, dirty, filthy animals.
Right.
But if you're going to get anything done, you're going to need those animals. And it's going to take the work and the mess to kind of get something done. And I think that's kind of that position
metaphor,
that I oftentimes find myself when people ask me about, you know, having somebody who's been in who's either still in active addiction or in recovery, you know, is it risky? Is it safe? And those sort of, it's like, we have to count those costs and we have to know there's potential for some mess that comes with that. And I can't tell you every situation you're going to find yourself in. There's going to, if you opened a tiny home thing on the property next to a church, there's going to be things that come up that the church wasn't ready to experience. If, you know, my church has gotten really involved in foster care ministry and we're trying to help train churches in how to be trauma-informed in the way that they respond in a foster care situation and understand adversity and understand what the situations are that kids are coming from. But even in getting into that, there are going to be brand new circumstances when you're trying to, you know, serve this kid that's coming out of who knows what that situation was by the time you met, that sort of thing. And you'd have to be kind of ready to answer that.
Yeah. And I think it's easy too to like see like to us and them this to say like, oh, it's those people out there that are messy and complicated. It's like, we are all that. And the church is full of people that it's all that too. So it's like, let's not overly like try to make it like, again, we're here to save you and give you all the solutions and like we're the holders of the power. I think when like ministry is done well, you're again coming alongside people and you realize you have as much to learn from them and they have as much to teach you. You have as many ways to grow as they do. So like we're all on a journey. This is all a pilgrimage. We're all being challenged to grow and we all have ways that we're going to be shaped and formed by our life experiences. Yeah.
So what are some ways, as you've been kind of studying this and seeing where some of the gaps are, maybe from obviously the government isn't going to fix everything. The city's not going to fix everything. No. I'm really excited about motivating and getting the church equipped to help people. And there's going to be overlap. And like, we're specifically focusing on addiction, but homelessness is directly connected with those things. What are some of the gaps that you've seen that perhaps the church could do a better job in stepping up and maybe kind of helping begin to fill some of those gaps?
Yeah, we were really excited last year. So for many years, my former employer, Salvation Army, has done what's called White Flag. It's the cold weather sheltering. So when it gets below 35 degrees, they offer 35 extra spots in their dining, 25 extra spots in their dining room, which are called white flag beds. They call it white flags. They literally hang a white flag on the side of the
building. We know it's cold.
Which signals to people, we're doing the extra beds tonight. And so it's inclement weather sheltering. But the problem was, is like, because our community's grown, like they were getting some nights where they were hitting that 25 max and they didn't have we didn't have a what now? Like what happens when we get to person 26? So one of the things that Opal and I focused on last fall was like, we need to get an overflow system set up. And so we reached out to to some church partners and we said, what would it look like to make sure we're in compliance with fire code? Because a lot of like church buildings or buildings that are not sprinklered, they don't have sprinklers. And so they're not supposed to be used for sheltering, but there's a workaround. So we worked with John City Fire Department to make sure we had fire watch. Somebody's awake at all times throughout the night, just looking for fire. Like that's part of the fire code. We were able to recruit three host sites that served as overflow sites. And so during a given week, we would say, okay, this church, you're on call. If we get to person 26, you would get person 26 and up to 12 additional people. We're going to get them checked into the system. Just like every other person, there's a system that HUD mandates. It's called HMIS, the Homeless Management Information System. So we have done a background check. We do know who this person is. It doesn't mean they don't have a criminal history, but we do. We have verified their identity.
Right.
We check and make sure they don't have any weapons on them. We safely store their meds, and then we can send them off to the overflow site. And we have trained volunteers that have been trained. So we had these overflow host sites that we identified, and we had a pool of trained volunteers that staffed the overnight shelters. Well, this was an essential thing because the Salvation Army ended up having a gas leak and had to close. And they couldn't take any of the first 25 people in February. So we had to scale up not one of these host overflow sites, but multiple in one night. We were able to shelter everyone last winter because of the hospitality of some of our partner churches offering their space, offering volunteers. So it was a really great example. And so that was a pilot last year. It was the first time we did this white flag overflow. We learned a lot. We made some mistakes. It wasn't perfect.
Right.
But we did a lot of good work. We're looking for churches and other civic organizations to come alongside us as we do that this coming winter.
Okay.
In order to like have a more robust, sustainable volunteer pool. We had a rotation of three overflow sites. We'd like to add a fourth or maybe fifth so right. that it's not as heavy on those locations. So that's a great way if your church wants to get involved. Maybe your church can't offer their space, but maybe you have people within your church that want to be trained as volunteers.
That was gonna be one of my other questions. Yeah. Like it doesn't always have to be all or nothing.
Exactly.
It can be what you can offer as well.
And this summer we're doing a similar thing. We're doing cooling centers. So we're partnering with Muncie has agreed, the Melting Pot Ministry has agreed to be our site. When it's get extremely hot during the daytime hours, there's been 4 days that we've opened cooling centers. And so we let people get in out of the heat, get into the air conditioning, have cool water. And so that's another thing. We would love to identify a couple more sites that would be willing to serve as a cooling center site, because there's times where Muncie can't have their staff there and we need to open, and we'd like to have one or two different other options in terms of facilities that would open as a cooling center. So there's, those are examples of ways that we've gotten churches involved.
And that also gives, again, going back to that relationship building, there's some proximity.
Yep,
right exactly. there. Yep. And I don't think, and if you're volunteering and you're volunteering a location, I don't think from a legal perspective, there's any reason that you can't also be open about who you are and why you care about the people that you're interacting with.
And we talked about that in our training. Like, again, the goal is not like proselytizing people, but like it's your space. You're free to, you know, like have conversations. And that's the same thing like when we did Family Promise and we had families staying in churches. We also don't want to say like, hey, you've got to do this Bible study while you're in here getting cooled off. Like, no, we can't like make people do the religious stuff in order to access the services.
But it doesn't have to stop at that one moment. Like if you hit it off with somebody and you have a great relationship, there's no reason that can't continue. That relationship can't continue beyond that one finite moment where you met.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing that we talk about too, is like, if you're giving somebody a ride and they say, hey, can you give me a ride to this some other time? We're not going to tell you can't. This is your ministry now.
Right.
This is your car.
Right.
Sure. There's specific things that we might ask if you could help us with. But if you end up wanting to really serve or build a relationship with a particular person that you meet or in the same situation, maybe it's like, this person is really looking for some community. Our church might could provide that.
Right.
There's no reason that relationship doesn't get to continue even after that. But a lot of times we shy away from that opportunity because we don't understand it. We're not really confident that it's going to work out.
And we tried to be intentional with, again, it's about a 2-hour training where we try to equip our people to know, like, so if somebody asks me for money, what do I do? Well, if somebody's having a mental health breakdown, what do I do? We offer some trauma-informed care training so people understand what trauma is so that they can try to, you know, show up and be fully present in a way like, hey, you need to show up and you need to be present And you need to understand you may have some of your own trauma that gets triggered by serving. And if you need to take a break and step away, like, take care of yourself. Like,
yeah.
But like all, like the training is pretty comprehensive in trying to help people realize, yes, there's potential things that could happen. We want to equip you for those potential emergency situations. But I would say 99% of the time that I've served in these capacities, it's doing what you do when you give people rides. You're just talking with people and spending time with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, it's just like the rest of your day and the rest of the people you interact with at the grocery store or at work or at church or at home. Yep. They just happen to be unhoused.
And being prepared on that front end just gives people, I think, the confidence to feel like, oh, yeah. I can do, it's not as mysterious,
yeah.
But also I think it's going to make it, because you don't have that same, you know, kind of, I don't know what I'm doing fear in the back of your mind when you step right. into that situation, it's going to kind of alleviate some of that stress. So you're going to feel like, oh, this is something I can keep doing. And I think it makes mm-hmm. it a lot more of a sustainable effort for folks
yeah.
when they just feel informed. Like, you don't have to know how to do everything, but just kind of take the edge off of that kind of mystery. And then when you put people in there, then once they kind of step in, everybody we talk to is like, oh yeah, this is great.
Yeah.
This is easy.
And what we found is that there's a lot of people that I think want to be a part of the solution. They just didn't know enough about what mm-hmm. was going on. So I appreciate you inviting me to talk. And like, this is a great opportunity. This is part of what we're trying to do more of, is just make sure people are informed of the reality of what's going on in our community and letting them know how they can help. Because we're finding that once people know more, they're like, oh, well, I can do that. I can do this. Like, they want to know what the little bite-sized pieces are,
yeah.
and they can identify their gifts. Like, well, we would really love to, like, volunteer with Family Promise because we think about families with kids and we want to be involved with families, or we really care about foster care, so we want to get involved with Smile Foster Closet and their program, or we really love veterans, so we want to get plugged in with the Salvation Army and what they're doing with their program. Like, there's endless organizations that have been in our community doing good work for a long time. All we're trying to do is get the word out about the needs and then maybe a little better align some of those yeah. resources and services, so we're all pulling in the same direction. And then when we identify gaps,
yeah.
trying to start some of these new programs to fill them.
Yeah, and I said, I might have said quickly, and it's such an easy thing. It's not necessarily always going to be easy, but what I mean by that is, like, it's such a simple thing to just kind of step in and make yourself available in right. one of these things. And it's a low barrier to entry kind of ministry, especially for our folks in churches. Because one of the things that I'm jealous for, I guess, is probably the best way to say it, is I want to help those, the 80% of the folks that maybe don't know how to actually get involved in ministry.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not trying to put more ministry work on the folks that are already active.
Yeah.
Because there's plenty of folks within the church that they're just looking for that opportunity. What's that going to look like? And these mm-hmm. and a lot of the stuff that you just talked about, and pairing that with transportation, I mean, I yeah. feel like if we can pair those kinds of things together, mm-hmm. it's such a low barrier to entry. It's like, you want to just kind of dip your toe and see what ministry to, in a way that will actually have a really long-term meaningful impact on people.
Yeah.
This is a great way to get yeah. started and get involved.
Take the next step. I don't know what that step looks like for you. I don't know what that step looks like for your church, but like, there yep. is probably a next step where you can be proximate and be intentional to, like, be a little bit yep. more engaged. So think about, you know, pray about, discern collectively as a community, like, what does that look like for you? And then, like, reach out. Like, we'd be glad to try to make introductions, like yep. introduce you to nonprofits. So
that was going to be my next question, is yep. if somebody does want to get involved, what's the best place for them to start?
Yeah. So again, they can just reach out to me by email. You can put it in the show notes if you want or whatever, but my email is aaronpatrickscott@gmail.com. You can reach out to me if I can be helpful in getting you or your organization connected to a way to get plugged in. Like, I'm happy to do that.
And we're gonna have to keep collaborating down the line, Adam, yeah. working these things together, because I feel like we're trying to do the same things, similar yeah. types of things in different areas, but it's all kind of coming from that same heart that we mm-hmm. that we have for these things. So
yeah,
well, this has been great. Thank you for hanging out. Thank you for talking. I know more about what the situation yeah. is, but I think it's also, like, I see again just how perfect an opportunity it is for the church to be the ones to kind yeah. of step in and start to fill some of these gaps.
So. Well, thank you. Thanks for the good work you guys do, and appreciate the opportunity.
Excited to keep working together.
Sounds good.
This has been a podcast powered by Uplift Appalachia. To learn more, you can find us at upliftappalachia.org or at Uplift Appalachia on Instagram.